The temperature, too, began to drop, with the wind blowing up from the pole. Before long, the surface of the sea was freezing into rubbery patches that would later become pancake ice. Shackleton ordered the Docker into the lead. The Caird was made fast to her stern, and the Wills brought up the rear. Two oars were put out from the Docker to keep the line of boats head up into the wind, and to prevent them from bumping into one another. By 10 o'clock they were in position. For the second night running, there was no sleep, though a few men snuggled together in hopes of generating enough warmth to drop off for a moment. But it was achingly cold. Huss's thermometers were packed away so that no actual temperature reading could be taken, but Shackleton estimated it to be 4 below 0. They could even hear the water freezing. The snow fell on the newly formed ice with a tiny crackling sound, and the ice itself made a creaking hiss as it rose to the swell. The clothes the men wore, now that they were sitting almost motionless, froze stiff. Not only were their garments wet from the spray and snow, they were also worn and saturated with the oil secreted from the men's own bodies during 6 months of constant wear. If a man shifted his position even slightly, his skin came in contact with the new, unwarmed surface of his clothing. Everyone tried to sit still, but it could not be done. The weariness, the lack of food, the exertion, and the worry had weakened them so that the harder they tried to sit still, the more they shivered, and their own shivering kept them awake. It was better to row. Shackleton, in the Caird, doubted that some men would survive the night. 100 times, it seemed, Worsley was asked what time it was. Each time he reached under his shirt and took out the chronometer he carried slung around his neck to keep it warm. Holding it up close to his face, he read its hands in the feeble light of the moon, shining through the thin snow clouds. In time, it became a kind of gruesome game, seeing who could hold out the longest before asking again what time it was. When finally somebody succumbed to the temptation, every head rose to await Worsley's answer. But the dawn did come, at last, and in its light the strain of the long dark hours showed on every face. Cheeks were drained and white, eyes were bloodshot from the salt spray and the fact that the men had slept only once in the past 4 days. Matted beards had caught the snow and frozen into a mass of white. Shackleton searched their faces for an answer to the question that troubled him most. How much more could they take? There was no single answer. Some men looked on the point of breaking, while others showed an unmistakable determination to hold out. At least, all of them had survived the night. Shortly after sunrise, the wind swung around to the southeast and freshened considerably. Shackleton called to Worsley to bring the Docker alongside the Caird. After a hurried conference, they announced that for the 4th time, the destination was changed. In view of the southeast wind, they would run for Elephant Island once more, now 100 miles to the northwest, and pray God the wind held fair till they arrived. After redistributing the stores so that the Wills was less crowded, the boats hoisted sail and set off with the Caird in the lead. They worked their way through the floes, and the men took turns leaning over the bows, trying to fend off the ice. Even so, there were a number of collisions, and the Caird was stove in slightly when she ran into a particularly large piece. Fortunately, the hole was above the waterline, but Shackleton ordered the boats to reduce sail to avoid further damage. The primer stoves were lighted once more, and a ration of hot milk was prepared. In addition, Shackleton said that all hands could eat all they wanted to make up for the cold and lack of sleep. It offered no enticement for some men, to whom seasickness was an additional misery. Aud Lees was worst off, or at least he complained the most. But there was little sympathy for him. He had done less than the others ever since they had taken to the boats. Often, when it came his turn to row, he pleaded with Worsley to let him off, claiming that he was sick or that he didn't know how to row well enough. As usual, Worsley found it difficult to be stern, and since there were always plenty of volunteer oarsmen wanting to get warm, Audley's was frequently allowed to skip his turn. On the rare occasions when he was ordered or shamed into taking up an oar, he managed to exhibit an ineptitude which won him a speedy relief. Several times when he was rowing ahead of Kerr, he kept just enough out of rhythm so that when he leaned back after every stroke, he smashed into Kerr's fingers behind him. Curses, threats, nothing had any effect on him. He seemed not even to hear. Finally, Kerr would ask Worsley to replace Ord Lee's. When Shackleton gave the order that unlimited food would be permitted, the men in the docker taunted Ord Lee's by making sure he saw them eating their fill in the hope that it would sicken him further. Toward 11 o'clock, the scattered pack began to thin out, though the boats were still faced with large patches of newly frozen slush. At one point, the pancake ice was littered with thousands of dead fish about 7 inches long, which apparently had been killed by a cold current. Vast numbers of fulmars and snow petrels swooped down to pick them off the ice. All the while, the wind was increasing. By late morning, it had risen almost to gale force and was driving the boats along at a remarkable clip. Just before noon, they burst from the line of pack into the open sea. The change was breathtaking. The northwest swell, which had been cushioned by the pack, now advanced upon the boats in undisguised immensity. Their course lay directly into it, and within minutes they were struggling up a hill of water whose face was a quarter mile long. At its summit, the wind shrieked, blowing the spray into thin, feathery lines. Then they started down, a slow but steep descent into the valley leading to the next swell. Over and over again the cycle was repeated. Before long, the pack was lost from sight, and occasionally one or another of the boats disappeared behind one of these enormous rolling hills of water. It was as if they'd suddenly emerged into infinity. They had an ocean to themselves, a desolate, hostile vastness. Shackleton thought of the lines of Coleridge. Alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea. They made a pitiable sight. Three little boats, packed with the odd remnants of what had once been a proud expedition, bearing 28 suffering men in one final, almost ludicrous bid for survival. But this time, there was to be no turning back, and they all knew it. The men clung to the sides of the pitching boats as they drove forward. Though they were making excellent headway, their progress was hard won. Both the docker and the Wills were shipping water continually. The crews sat facing aft with the wind directly in their faces, a position only slightly preferable to facing forward, where they would have been stung by the spray breaking over the side. By mid-afternoon, the wind had risen even more, so Shackleton ordered a second reef taken in the sails, and they proceeded this way until dusk. At sunset, Worsley drew the docker alongside the Caird and urged that they continue. But Shackleton flatly refused. It was difficult enough, he said, to keep the boats together in daylight. At night, it would be impossible. He even rejected Worsley's suggestion that they join up and row during the night. Shackleton was convinced that their best chance of reaching safety was to remain together. Both the Caird and the Wills were largely dependent on Worsley's skill as a navigator, and Shackleton was acutely aware that the Wills needed constant looking after. Not only was she the least seaworthy of the three boats, but Hudson, who was commanding her, was one of those less equal to the strain, and he was obviously weakening, both physically and mentally. Shackleton was certain the Wills would be lost if she got separated from the others. He decided that the three boats would spend the night hove to. He ordered the docker to rig a sea anchor, and the Caird made fast to the docker's stern with the Wills behind her. Working with stiffening fingers, Worsley, Greenstreet, and MacLeod lashed three oars together and stretched a piece of canvas across them. The contrivance was then made fast to a long piece of line and pitched over the side. They hoped the sea anchor would act as a brake, holding the bows of the boats up into the wind as it was dragged through the water. When it was in position, the crews of all three boats settled down to wait for morning. Never was there a worse night. As the darkness deepened, the wind increased, and the temperature dropped ever lower. Again, an actual reading was impossible, but it was probably at least as low as 8 below. It was so cold that the seas that broke over them froze almost as soon as they hit. Even before the darkness was complete, it became apparent that the sea anchor could not hold them up into the wind effectively. The boats continually dropped off into the trough of the waves where they were swept broadside by the seas. The boats, the men, everything was soaked, then frozen. Most of the men tried to shelter themselves under the tent cloths, but the wind repeatedly tore them loose. On the Caird, they managed to make enough room for four men to huddle together at one time in the pile of sleeping bags in the bow, and they took turns trying in vain to sleep. On the Docker, however, there was only room enough for the men to sit upright, huddled together with their feet squeezed between the cases of stores. The seas that came on board ran down into the bottom of the boat, and since most of the men were wearing felt boots, their feet were soaked all night in the icy water. They did what they could to keep the boats baled dry, but the water sometimes rose ankle-deep. To keep their feet from freezing, they worked their toes constantly inside their boots. They could only hope that the pain in their feet would continue, because comfort, much as they yearned for it, would mean that they were freezing. After a time, it took extreme concentration for them to keep wiggling their toes. It would have been so terribly easy just to stop. As the hours dragged by and their agony deepened, the men in the docker fought back with the single pitifully ridiculous weapon they had. Curses. They cursed everything cursible, the sea, the boat, the spray, the cold, the wind, and often one another. There was a kind of pleading tone to their curses, though, as if they were prayerfully appealing for a deliverance from this wet and freezing misery. Most of all, they cursed Ord Lees, who had got hold of the only set of oilskins and refused to give them up. He maneuvered himself into the most comfortable position in the boat by shoving Marston out, and he would not move. He either ignored or was oblivious to the oaths flung at him. After a while, Marston gave up and made his way to the stern, where he sat down alongside Worsley at the tiller. For a time, there was only the moaning of the wind through the rigging. Then, to give vent to his rage, Marston began to sing. He sang one song, then waited, and then another. Finally, he repeated over and over, in a tired, thin voice, a song whose chorus went, "Twankadillo, Twankadillo, and the roaring pair of bagpipes made from the green willow." Throughout the night, the men were troubled by the need to urinate frequently. Certainly the intense cold was a factor in this condition, and the two physicians believed it was aggravated by the fact that they were continually wet, so that they absorbed water through their skin. Whatever the reason, it required a man to leave the slight comfort of the sheltering canvas and make his way to the lee side of the boat several times during the night. Most of the men also had diarrhea from their diet of uncooked pemmican, and they would suddenly have to rush for the side and, holding fast to a shroud, sit on the frozen gunwale. Invariably, the icy sea wet them from beneath. By far the worst off of the boats was the Wills. The water she was shipping was sometimes almost knee-deep. Little Wally Howe, the seaman, found it impossible to drive from his mind the fear that a killer whale would upset them into the water. Stevenson, the fireman, periodically buried his face in his hands and wept. Blackborough, who'd insisted on wearing leather boots to save his felt pair for what he thought would be the future, lost all feeling in his feet after several hours. And Hudson, who had been at the tiller for almost 72 hours straight, developed a pain in his left buttock, which became increasingly intense as the part began to swell. After a time, he had to sit hunched sideways, and the rolling of the boat was agony to him. He was also suffering from severe frostbite in his hands. The line between the Wills and the Caird alternately tightened and slacked, dropping into the water and rising into the bitter cold air each time. As the hours passed, it accumulated an ever-thickening coat of ice. The lives of the 8 men aboard the Wills depended on that line.